And good morning. KBOO Portland is the station, your community radio.
Don't give up the fight.
Coming up in a half hour, join us for Fight the Empire. We've got Air Cascadia live at 10 o'clock this morning with Chris Andre. Then at 10:15, Flashpoints will be off. Instead, we've got something called Radio Eco Shock. That'll be at 10:15 once again. At 11 on Between the Covers, we'll speak with Oregon author Gina Oshner about her brand new novel. That's all coming up, but first, Press Watch with host Teresa Mitchell speaking with environmental activist Bill McKibben about the state of the climate movement and his event this weekend here in Portland. That is coming up next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Rent Tents Development. Who does the City Council represent on Friday, October 21st at Revolution Hall in Portland? Rents Tents and Development is an election debate featuring candidates for Portland City Commissioner Chloe Udaly and Steve Novick. This event will focus on how housing intersects with other social justice causes and the candidates' vision of how we can take local action to change housing policy in our city. Again, that's Rents Tents Development. Who does City Council represent on Friday, October 21st at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland? More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Jill Stein is coming to Portland. She'll be at the Roseland Theater Sunday the 23rd. The event is 5 to 9 p.m. with the NoPo Big Band, local Green candidates, and Kshama Sawant. Jill's speech will be followed by a Q&A session. I will be the master of ceremonies there, so expect a fine time with fine people. That's Jill Stein, Sunday, Roseland Theater. Today I'm joined by best-selling author, environmentalist activist, and leader of 350.org, Bill McKibben. He is the Schumann Distinguished Scholar at Middlebury College and recipient of the Gandhi Peace Award. Bill McKibben, welcome back to KBOO Radio.
Always very good to be with you.
I'm so glad that you could join us. I'd like to ask you, what do you think of Proposition I-732 in Washington, the carbon tax swap?
Well, I think that I don't know an immense amount about it, but I know that the local chapter of 350 in Washington decided not to endorse it. And the reason that they gave was that there wasn't the full consultation with communities of color in the drafting of it. And I think that the moment when the environmental movement was mostly white and didn't pay attention to frontline communities is probably it's probably a good thing that we're trying very hard to get past it now.
People of color are in a desperate fight for survival against white supremacy in our society and institutions like our police departments. So let me bring that up. What's the relation of 350.org to the fight against racial marginalization?
Well, people at 350 have worked pretty closely with Black Lives Matter across the country, and it goes in both both directions. You know, it was really good to see the Black Lives Matter charter this year calling for fossil fuel divestment. People have a sense that these, you know, some people think that these are all just kind of unconnected ideas, but in fact, marginalization is something that crosses the spectrum. I mean, the same people who have to worry about what happens if they get pulled over by the police are oftentimes, very oftentimes, the same people living in the communities who have to worry about the air they breathe because they're downwind of whatever it's bad to be downwind of.
So you have an intersectional attitude, a solidarity attitude.
Yeah.
Democracy Now! Has been covering the Standing Rock, has been covering the Standing Rock North Dakota Access Pipeline protest, and you have been involved as well. How important is that fight?
I've been doing what I can from a distance to support it because I think it's the most important fossil fuel fight in the country, but in some ways the most important justice fight in the country that that there is. You know, what's happening up there on the High Plains and the Dakotas is a really dramatic moment. And I think there's several things that about it are important. One is that Indian nations by the hundreds are coming together in a show of unity that we've never seen on this continent before. The second is that the wisdom of those most ancient traditions on this continent, the only people who successfully inhabited it over the long term, are combining with the latest wisdom from climate scientists. They're pointing us in the same direction. And I guess the third thing is, and the saddest thing is, that as usually happens, all that wisdom is being met by just full-on repression. The pictures of police dogs sicked on peaceful protesters there, or security guard dogs. I mean, those pictures could have come out of Birmingham in 1963, except that instead of African Americans this time, it was Native Americans.
350 PDX convened the Portland Shell No Coalition that led to thousands of participants joining the Shell No actions to oppose and draw attention to Shell's Arctic drilling. The Kai activists and Greenpeace bridge hangers delayed a Shell Arctic icebreaker ship for nearly 2 days. It was a heck of a visual impact. The photos went viral worldwide. Following the action, Shell Oil pulled out of the Arctic. President Obama announced an end to leasing the Arctic for drilling for 2 years. Are further such actions in the planning stages by 350.org?
Well, first of all credit to wonderful activists from 350 and Greenpeace and everybody else out there in Portland and in Seattle, too. The birth of kayaktivism, at least on this continent, was a really wonderful thing to get to witness from a distance. And you should know that, you know, it's not just here. One of the most exciting actions of the last couple of years were, I guess you couldn't quite call them Kai activists, but down across the low-lying Pacific Islands that are going to disappear in this century if we don't get our act together. You know, activists from all those islands, from 350 in the Pacific, built on each island a traditional canoe. These are big seagoing canoes, and they took them off to the biggest coal port in the world, which is Newcastle, Australia. And they used them there to blockade that biggest warships on the planet for a day with those canoes. And it was amazing. And it had much the same galvanizing effect. It wasn't long afterwards when plans were effectively shelved for what would have been the world's largest coal mine there in Queensland in Australia. So it's a tactic we're pretty good on land, we're pretty good at sea. I don't know whether I guess we'll have to explore aerial activity next.
An article in mybroadband.co.za is saying that South Africa is looking at major energy expenditures, and they are considering knocking a planned nuclear plant off the table because solar and wind bids are coming in at 40 or 50% less than a nuke per kilowatt hour, and that also puts renewable at a similar advantage to coal. Meanwhile, the Japanese government is so afraid of news getting out about Fukushima and the contamination of that area and Tokyo that they have passed a secrecy law. What does this portend for the nuclear industry?
I think that the numbers about renewable energy are just astonishing. I mean, this is probably the most important economic fact on the planet, is that in the last 8 years, the price of a solar panel has dropped 80%. That's amazing. And it undercuts the fossil fuel industry, it undercuts the nuclear industry, it undercuts everybody who's not figuring out how to take advantage of the sun and the wind. And that's not, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Africa, because it's not just these sort of plans for big grid power that are being disrupted. It's the ways that people get energy in their daily lives. I've just been up in Humboldt in Northern California, where the energy lab there is at the forefront of helping figure out how to bring solar energy in particular to non-connected parts of Africa, which is most of the continent, where people still burn kerosene and inhale the particulates. And the strides that are being made are really astonishing in the ability to get this stuff out and fast. So, I spend much of my time being pessimistic because the climate science is very pessimistic. But the rapid fall in the price of renewable energy gives us, if we wanted to, the possibility of having some hope of dealing with climate change. Whether we'll muster the political will is a different question, but if we didn't have the technology, the political will wouldn't do us much good. At least we know what we could be doing instead of what we have been doing.
Bill McKibben, are you opposed to nuclear poison power?
To nuclear what?
Poison power.
I don't think it's going to play much of a role at all in where we're going in the future. I think the only places that are going to build them in serious numbers, and even there unlikely, are authoritarian countries where you can push them through. I don't think anyone's going to build them here. And I think, along with the issues that you raise around their safety, probably the biggest reason they won't get built is their cost. You might as well burn $20 bills to generate electricity. The cost curve for building a nuclear power plant just keeps going up and up and up, while the price of sun and wind just keeps coming down and down and down.
It certainly seems to be the case. 30 years ago, I was involved in an effort to expose and protest the U.S. proxy war in Central America, and I was involved in anti-apartheid efforts and received surveillance and threats from government-affiliated thugs. Now I hear that you are experiencing the same sort of thing. What's happening, and how do you intend to deal with it?
Well, it's not exactly government of, well, I mean, who knows how all that works, but government affiliated, it's more, these guys were quite out in the open. It was a group called America Rising, a big right-wing political action committee run by people who run presidential campaigns for, you know, Romney and so on in the past. And they said that they were going to subject me to a level of what they said opposition research that and video tracking that normally they had only reserved for presidential candidates they didn't like. And so indeed, often when I'm out in public or kind of semi-public, there are people, you know, with video cameras photographing everything I do, and they're doing all kinds of opposition research on my personal life and that kind of thing. I don't really know what to do about it except persevere. People say one should treated as with a certain amount of as a certain kind of flattery. I guess it's a sign that we're costing them enough money to make it worth their while. Things like the fight around the Keystone Pipeline. But I got to say, I don't enjoy it one bit. It's hard to just sort of shrug it off and continue on.
Well, then I'd like to personally thank you for your perseverance. Democracy Now! Reported Tuesday that a new study by the United Nations has found climate change could drive 122 million more people into extreme poverty in the next 15 years, in part due to the impact it is already having on small-scale farmers. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. I mean, look, we see it every damn day around the world. I mean, today, while everybody was, glued to the debate last night, another typhoon, Haima, was crashing into the Philippines, into Luzon. It followed the same track that a typhoon had followed the week before. So that one had dropped 20 inches of rain, and this one dropped another 10 inches of rain. You can imagine the landslides and craziness that resulted, and you can imagine how impossible it is to be a farmer in that. I mean, what do you do? I mean, the Hurricane Matthew that crashed into Haiti 2.5 weeks ago destroyed 90% or 100% of the crops across that southwest peninsula where it came in. I mean, people literally have nothing to eat.
And it means that they must migrate, I suppose.
Well, this is the kind of migratory pressure we're seeing. The academic research say on what happened in Syria is pretty clear now. One of the biggest factors leading to the civil war, and hence the, along with our witless plan to invade Iraq, was the fact that there was the deepest drought in the history of what we used to call the Fertile Crescent. And a million farmers were driven off their land and into cities, and it just overwhelmed what was already a not very useful government there in Syria. And, now we see the just endless waves of misery that spread out from it. That's what happens. We have this idea that, we live in a world of politics and economics and so on, which we do. But at bottom, at root, at base, we live on a physical planet. And that physical planet is turning into a very, very chaotic place.
And for that reason, you have been suggesting a World War II level mobilization against climate change. Could you expand on that?
I wrote a piece this summer saying, we're used to these sort of phony, like, wars on whatever, the war on drugs, whatever. In this case, it's sort of the reverse. We're losing a war. We're losing territory and lives daily. I was writing it after having been in the Pacific with our crew there this spring, watching as the coral reefs that ring so many of those islands died in the course of a week or two, as this wave of hot water swept across the Pacific and the Indian Oceans. And it felt like, one was in a war. So my suggestion was that we try to fight back the way we did against fascism in World War II. And one of the things that interested me was looking at the history of that period and how quickly we mobilized industrially once government started telling business that that's what it was going to do. We learned to build very complicated things very fast. Within a year, they built the biggest factory in the world in Michigan, and it was churning out complicated machines, bombers, which have 300,000 rivets. We were doing one of those an hour. We need to be building at the same scale solar panels and wind turbines. We need to do it because that's what we'll have to do if we're going to stabilize the climate. But it is worth noting, as I did in that piece in the New Republic, that this also had salutary economic effect for this country, and it could for the whole world. We'd need to put a lot of people to work doing this, And probably one way to do it would be to spend somewhat less than we now spend building the bombers and things that we no longer need anywhere near as badly as we need solar panels and wind turbines.
There was an accidental social bonus as well, I suppose, because people had to use coupons to buy butter or meat, and you couldn't even go on the road without seeing imprecations against excessive travel. But people had a sense of solidarity and a sense of a shared struggle. Is that what you hope for in the struggle against climate change?
The battle against fascism in the middle of the last century was the most important battle of its time, and the people who fought it, you know, had to take real risks. A lot of them died, and they had to kill people, which is, God forbid. We don't have to do either of those things, but we do have to, as you say, demonstrate some kind of actual solidarity. And this time it has to be global, not national.
Quoting the International Business Times in a meeting with environmentalists last year in which they probed Democratic U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton on renouncing fossil fuels, former Secretary of State dismissed the activists, saying they should get a life. The revelation came about when WikiLeaks dumped more emails from the accounts of Clinton aide John Podesta last Saturday. If Clinton becomes president, what will your strategy be to pressure her into supporting action against climate change?
I wrote a piece about all of this in The Nation yesterday, I think, and I said if she wins, the honeymoon is going to be the shortest on record. It's going to last about 10 minutes because people who care about climate know exactly how she feels about the fact that we should get a life, about the fact that she likes fracking, you know, on and on. We're going to have to challenge her really hard, and we can't make the mistake we did with Obama, which was walking away for a couple of years and thinking that everything would be okay. I mean, I think Bernie said it correctly. As soon as she's in office, the challenge has to be unrelenting.
You are coming to Portland. I'm going to start wrapping up because you said you had 20 minutes.
Yes.
The name of the event is The Sky is the Limit, an evening with Bill McKibben. And the text is, join 350PDX on Sunday, October 23rd, for a special talk by Bill McKibben, world-renowned environmental activist, author and founder of 350.org at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in downtown Portland. Tickets are $10 for students and $20 general admission. No one will be turned away for lack of funds. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and program begins at 7. Music and intro featuring the Rhodes Sodas and NAACP President Joanne Hardesty, and a reception afterwards. Did I get up just about all of it?
You know more about it than I do, but that sounds right to me. And I was supposed to be there in the spring to do this thing for 350 PDX, and then Bernie asked me to go serve on the platform committee and try to write the platform, so I had to cancel it. And I'm very, very glad to be able to get there, if for no other reason than just to get to say thanks once again to people in Portland for telling Shell to where to go, and for becoming the first city in the country to ban new fossil fuel infrastructure. Those are good things. There's some stuff to celebrate.
There, you heard it from the lips of the winner of the Gandhi Peace Prize, Bill McKibben. Thank you so much for joining KBOO Portland once again.
A real pleasure. Take care.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to KBOO Portland. This is Press Watch. My name is Teresa Mitchell. Call in to your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. From Earth First Journal, a filmmaker has been charged with three felonies after being arrested by police in North Dakota for filming activists shutting down the valve of a tar sands pipeline owned by TransCanada Keystone. She was one of nine arrested. Dayas Schlossberg was charged with three felonies, two Class A, one Class C, on Thursday. The charges included conspiracy to theft of property, conspiracy to theft of services, and conspiracy to tampering with or damaging a public service. The charges can be combined in a 45-year maximum sentence. And again, this is for filming the action. as a journalistic venture. Schlossberg, a producer for Josh Fox, was arrested and her footage confiscated on Tuesday after filming protesters breaking into a Valve station owned by TransCanada in Walhalla, North Carolina. That's from Earth First Journal. And before I read more of that, I want to comment that this story has been very effectively suppressed. Maybe you heard of it because you're a KBOO listener. But the fact is, activists approached several major pipelines after scientifically studying how to shut them down without breaking them, because if you just turn a valve on a 1,000-pound pressure pipeline, it's going to break and spill all over the place. They learned how to shut them down, and they very carefully broke into many stations across the country and shut down Canada to U.S. pipelines. A very major sabotage action, carefully carried out and absolutely kept out of the press. You are not allowed to know this. This is news you're not supposed to know. Returning to the article from Earth First, the action was part of a multi-state protest by Climate Direct Action, which vandalized five pipeline valve stations in multiple states on Tuesday to protest the movement of tar sands oil, fracked oil, from Canada into the U.S. and to show solidarity with ongoing protests in North Dakota. Eight others were arrested and initially charged with trespassing. This should have been absolutely the top news item, except that in fear and terror that others would get the same sort of idea, or that solidarity might break out with the saboteurs, in my opinion. Whatever the reason was, this was kept out of the news, and it is huge news. Court records say Michael Foster and Samuel Jessup were charged with a total of 14 criminal charges for interfering with the emergency valves of TransCanada's Keystone Pipeline. Foster alone faces eight criminal charges, the most serious being theft of property, theft of services, two counts of criminal conspiracy, all Class A felony crimes. They intend to put these people down for most of the rest of their lives. Prosecutors in Minnesota filed felony charges against two members of the same activist group for similarly tampering with two Enbridge pipelines. So that article is at Earth First Journal. That's earthfirstjournal.org. Did you even know that existed? From Radio Havana, Cuba, in Mexico, the Zapatistas argued at 20th anniversary National Indigenous Congress that resource exploitation will ultimately destroy the earth. The event marks 20 years since the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, also known as the EZLN or Zapatistas, first launched the National Indigenous Congress as rallying cry. In the early years after the movement emerged from the Lacandon jungle and declared war against the Mexican state, the gathering brought together indigenous peoples from Mexico and other countries, including Colombia and Guatemala, to share experiences, discuss collective challenges, and advance their struggles through solidarity. A number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. The iconic Subcomandante Marcos, also known as Subcomandante Galeano, made a rare appearance, and the Zapatistas renewed their call for indigenous unity across Mexico in the face of what the movement recognizes as runaway social and environmental destruction in the interest of a few, while the people, especially indigenous communities, suffer the consequences. Also from Radio Havana, Cuba, Dateline Seattle, a U.S. federal judge has ordered former high-ranking CIA officials to testify in a lawsuit against the psychologist who designed the spy agency's torture techniques after the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks. The U.S. District Court Judge Justin Quackenbush in Spokane, Washington, issued the order. Among those ordered to give depositions under oath in the next few months are John Rizzo, the CIA's former chief lawyer, and Jose Rodriguez, the head of the CIA Counterterrorism Center after the 9/11 attacks. The judge also ordered a current CIA lawyer, Jonathan Friedman, and retired intelligence officer, James Katsana, to testify according to the ACLU. The case was brought by the ACLU on behalf of three men, Suleiman Salim, Gul Rahman, and Mohammed Ahmed Bin Sud. The men affirmed they were tortured using techniques developed by a CIA contracted psychologist, James Mitchell, and John Bruce Jessen. More on that at Radio Havana, Cuba. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Once again, I'll be at the Roseland Sunday, and Jill Stein will be there. I'll be the Master of Ceremonies. That'll be at 6:30 p.m., 6 o'clock p.m. And coming up on Fight the Empire, Per Fargering is going to interview, well, maybe I should make it a secret, another very important interview. Stay tuned and find out just who Per is going to interview. And you've been listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Cascadia and KBOO.FM, where we broadcast to the world and all the ships at sea.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Affording the Portland We Want, October 20th, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Walt McRee, chair of the Public Banking Institute, will discuss how a public bank of Portland could free up financial resources to build the Portland we want with the money we already have. How can we retain control of our tax dollars to invest at home instead of sending it off to Wall Street? Again, that's Affording the Portland We Want, October 20th at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information about the event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Bear Fogring, and the show is Fight the Empire, and my guest